Good morning, everyone out there in KBOO land. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, and it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Patricia Kullberg, and I'll be your host for our show today. Before we get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO is your local listener-supported community radio station, which means it exists because people like you support it. 80% of our funding comes from our listeners. Please, if you can, donate today. There's a big donate button on our website at kboo.fm. Today on our show, Chelsea Ratzlaff explores the intersection of music, mental health, and radical organizing with singer-songwriter and Chicana lesbian activist Naomi Little Bear Morena. Jan Hocken speaks with author and English professor Rachel Greenwald Smith about the nature of political compromise and who pays the price. To start off our show, Bill Resnick reminds our listeners that the United States has a long history of overseas intervention to suppress liberatory movements and maintain U.S. hegemony. Interventions which have never ended well. Afghanistan is only the most recent example. Bill speaks with professor and Middle East specialist Stephen Zunis about how we got into Afghanistan and what the national security apparatus has up its sleeve for our next series of interventions. Do you remember how Reagan stoked the rise of the Taliban in the 1980s? Well, listen up. Here's Bill.
Stephen Zunis, welcome to KBOO.
Great to be with you again.
Stephen Zunis studies and writes on the international system and its politics. He specializes in the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, and strategic nonviolent action. He teaches at the University of San Francisco, coordinates its program in Middle Eastern studies. He's also active, and he writes a good deal. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. So, Stephen Zunis, how did you feel, what did you think when watching last week's news, the U.S. embassy personnel ferried from the top of the embassy, as in Saigon, so it seems like eternity ago, as the Taliban completed their over 20-year struggle with a lightning campaign to take over Afghanistan?
First of all, I think it's important to note that it was not a military victory by the Taliban. It was basically a political collapse of the Afghan regime. Let's remember that, nominally at least, the Afghan government had over 300,000 troops at its disposal, whereas the Taliban only had 75,000 troops. The Afghan government had an air force. They had heavy equipment. They'd gotten trained by the U.S. military for nearly 20 years. They had received over $100 billion in direct U.S. military aid. I mean, there was no reason on a military basis that they wouldn't have been able to keep the Taliban at bay. But what they lacked was legitimacy in the eyes of the majority of Afghans, who saw them essentially as puppets of a foreign power. The corruption was widespread. I mean, they're considered one of the five most corrupt governments in the world. So, and I think Biden was correct when he asked the question about why should Americans fight and die to preserve a regime that Afghans themselves were unwilling to do so for.
My sense of it, though, I mean, that seems to me the analysis of why the regime fell. I think that one could probably add to it that after Trump made a deal to leave, and Biden, in fact, himself said he wanted to leave, the Taliban undoubtedly, and also the leaders of all the various sects and local and regional groupings of various Muslim and other sort of faiths, they must have decided, well, we better make a deal with our next set of oppressors. And I think the Taliban probably did make a deal with them. I've read that, hint of that. It does seem to me the Taliban were extremely clever and the U.S. wasn't, but that's another matter. I found it, though, sort of heartbreaking watching what was happening and knowing what was going to happen to people accused of being collaborators with the United States.
Yeah, it's really horrible. And of course, the United States, indeed, I believe, has a moral responsibility to help people who may be targeted by the Taliban because of their collaboration with the United States and who might otherwise be subjected to persecution for political asylum. I mean, it's ironic that some of the very Republicans who are attacking Biden for supposedly abandoning the Afghans have also made it very, very difficult for the United States to bring in asylum seekers from Muslim countries. But in many ways, I think Biden was indeed caught in a trap by Trump. Trump, without consulting the Afghan government, made a deal with the Taliban and talks in Qatar last year, where basically the Taliban agreed not to never again harbor international terrorists like al-Qaeda and not to attack U.S. forces as long as U.S. forces withdrew by May. Now, what Biden did was he put off the deal for another few months, but he was in a situation where he had to either honor the agreement of his predecessor, or he could say, no, the deal's off, we're going to keep troops there, which basically made it so that if he kept the U.S. there, that then they would be subject to attacks and we'd be caught in this big, long, bloody war and Americans were getting killed. And again, he was realizing that, you know, if he could keep U.S. troops there another year, another 5 years, another 20 years, it would be the same thing. And the result would be the same, that when the U.S. finally did pull out, the Taliban would take over. So in a sense, this is a giant Ponzi scheme. I mean, this is the house of cards, and I have to... And though I've been quite critical of President Biden on a number of foreign policy issues, I think he was correct in this case and being willing to call out the Ponzi scheme, even though there are some people who are now blaming him. In fact, it's ironic that the Republicans, you know, who praised Trump when he made this deal, are now attacking Biden for going through with it.
Stephen Zunis, last week I read an article in the New York Times. It was a week ago, Sunday. It was titled, "Sweep by Taliban Follows Years of Miscalculation." And it was about how all with its super-modern high-tech weaponry, the U.S. was defeated by basically a fundamentalist nationalist force that was able to field a relatively disciplined, brutal, motivated guerrilla army. But the outcome, that outcome was not the result of miscalculation. Nor was Vietnam a miscalculation, nor was Iraq, nor is Honduras today, which is a death squad country destroyed recently by the U.S. because the elected leader was threatening to raise taxes and do a few other things on U.S. interests and economic interests in Honduras. Anyway, it's clear those murderous disasters were and are not the product of miscalculation, but the product of U.S. policy, that is to undermine and exterminate the leadership of the country after, in fact, it was forced to seek help from the Russians or Chinese. The irony this time was, it was particularly ironic this time, the Taliban force in its early days developed with the help of U.S. funding and support. Let's backtrack a little.
Sure. You look back in the United States supported some of the most hardline extremist elements in the anti-Soviet resistance back in the 1980s on the grounds that these hardcore ideological Islamists would be less likely to negotiate a compromise and negotiate a peace settlement, because the goal of the United States was not really to liberate Afghanistan from the Soviets, but to basically bleed the Soviets dry. That is, to get them bogged down in a long counterinsurgency war and therefore weaken them as our superpower rival. And we were willing to support the Hekmatyar faction, Hizbi Islami, these really fanatical extremists that when the Soviets are finally driven out were wrecking so much havoc across Afghanistan. I mean, there's a civil war in the 1990s, and it was the Taliban that ended up filling in that gap. Now, the Taliban was never directly supported by the U.S., but we did play a major role in their creation in the sense that the Taliban, which is basically the Pashtun word for students, grew out of these far right-wing madrasas, these religious schools that the U.S. encouraged the Saudis to set up in the refugee camps in Pakistan, where you had millions of Afghan refugees. These are virtually the only education that was available, and these kids were indoctrinated with this Salafist, Wahhabist against, you know, extremism like they practice in Saudi Arabia. And the, you know, the Afghans have always been fairly conservative and devout in their Islamic faith, but the Saudi-style stuff was a new thing. This was something that, you know, that came fairly recently, and it was the people who went through the these Islamic schools, the Saudis and the U.S. set up, formed the basis of the Taliban. And in that sense, I think, you know, the U.S. does indeed, you know, bear responsibility in large part, you know, for the rise of this particularly extremist and reactionary form of Islamic governance that we're now seeing.
This is Bill Resnick, Cable Radio, the Omo Variety Hour, talking to Stephen Zunis, who teaches at the University of San Francisco, specializing in the Middle East, U.S. foreign policy, strategic nonviolent action. His best-known book is Tinderbox, U.S. Foreign Policy and the Roots of Terrorism. We've been discussing the debacle of Afghanistan, the U.S. responsibility for the ruination of Afghanistan, and the heartbreaking situation of most Afghans now. So, Stephen Zunis, the Afghan story is not over. The Taliban are in control. They're surely going to declare Sharia law particularly harmful to the women of Afghanistan. But there are questions about how sweeping and how many people they will deem collaborators and how they will deal with them. They're very unlikely to start killing all the troops that surrendered to them, and they owe some obligations to the various allies who broke with the Afghan government and the U.S. military when it was clear that the war was about to end. Perhaps the Taliban leadership, it might be concerned with their international legitimacy and recognition and development assistance as they govern a ruined country. Stephen, what's your sense of the Taliban? Can they be dealt with, not by the U.S., but maybe some international body attached to the United Nations? Does Afghanistan have any future?
It's hard to say. I mean, again, the good news is I don't think there will be a base for international terror like Al-Qaeda again, but I think there's real good reason to be concerned about the fate of the Afghans themselves. I mean, the initial reports coming out thus far are that there have not been mass executions or some of the more draconian measures that we remember from the Taliban's rule during the 1990s up to 2001. But these guys are pretty bad news in any case. It's not going to be pretty. Now, the one thing that might give some glimmer of hope is that there was, despite many U.S. policies to the contrary that did not support this sort of thing, there has been some growth in Afghan civil society. There are some projects by the United Nations, NGOs that help facilitate this. In certain ways, I think the Afghans living in urban areas, may be able to resist simply through non-cooperation some of the more draconian measures that the Taliban might otherwise be willing to impose. In other words, I think the Afghans' ability to resist might be better than it was during the Taliban's previous rule. So I don't think the Taliban has, I don't think they've had a conversion of in the sense that I don't think they've seen the error in their ways and they're going to be moderates now. I don't think that at all. But I think they might be, pragmatic enough to recognize, the lack of support they actually have. The lack of support for the previous government doesn't mean that people support the Taliban either. The Taliban are largely able to fill the vacuum, from the collapse of the government. And so I'm hoping, though, again, it's just a hope. I'm hopeful there'll be at least some, level in which the Taliban's rule, might not be as extreme, that they might be more pragmatic, et cetera. But again, it looks like a pretty dark future for the Afghans with the Taliban in charge, regardless.
This is Bill Resnick for our Old Mole Variety Hour on Cable Radio, talking to Stephen Zunis, who teaches and writes on the Middle East at the University of San Francisco. It's a private university in San Francisco. He's written a good deal. It's a really interesting book on strategic nonviolence. So, Stephen, the U.S. national security elite after 9/11, almost 10 years ago, focused on the Middle East. They decided it was good idea to take control of Iraq and Afghanistan and make them Western-style democracies with their free market economies. That is a model for Egypt and Lebanon, among others. And they also were going to influence Saudi Arabia and the Gulf states in human rightsy and democratic directions. And they were going to solve the Israel-Palestine conflict. Well, of course, everything now is much worse with their work. 10 years later, having failed in just about everything, they appear ready to wash their hands of the Middle East and refocus on big power politics and that whole apparatus, military industrial complex, whole intellectual apparatus within political science departments around the United States and the neocons. They're now hyping and warning all of us to recognize that the Chinese are bent on world domination and we have to rearm to stop them. Of course, ignoring that they ignore that the great threat we actually face is global warming that all of us on the planet face. Anyway, they found a new enemy that we must spend a fortune on for consultants and think tanks and, of course, the military and military goods to defend our country. Stephen, maybe I'm exaggerating or being too colorful, but I believe that's correct in terms of the coming direction of U.S. foreign military policy.
Well, first of all, I never thought that democracy was part of the equation. I mean, that was sort of the excuse. I mean, the United States is under both Republican and Democratic administrations has propped up some of those brutal dictatorships in the world. Right now, Biden is siding with the Republicans and fighting with Democrats in Congress who want to put some human rights provisions into the massive amounts of taxpayer-funded military aid we give to prop up the Sisi dictatorship in Egypt, one of the most brutal regimes in the world in terms of the number of political prisoners, extrajudicial killings, torture, and the like. We support the Biden and continue the Republican support of the Israeli occupation, as well as Morocco's occupation of Western Sahara, including their illegal annexation of that African nation. You know, arms are still flowing to the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Bahrainis, and other family dictatorships in the Gulf. So, the line about that we're trying to bring democracy to Afghanistan and Iraq was disingenuous from the beginning. If we really wanted democracy, we would push democracy in countries we actually had some influence over, not ones that we were trying to invade. But in terms of your broader question, most strategic analysts recognize that the most important region in the world in the coming years will be Asia, with the rise of China and the rapid economic development in that part of the world. And ever since Obama, there's been an effort to shift our strategic attention there. But unfortunately for U.S. policy planners, the messes that we created in the Middle East, particularly during the Bush era, but some of the longer-term problems, such as the unconditional U.S. support for Israel, which has made it impossible for any kind of peace settlement to emerge there. We have these ongoing conflicts that have ended up sapping the attention of our strategic planners and others who would like to move on. Now, with the fact that the rise of access to natural gas, and more importantly, the very exciting developments that we have made in terms of renewable energy and conservation mean that the oil that's always been a center of U.S. Middle East policy is less and less of an issue. And that, again, can also make it so that the U.S. could put its attention elsewhere. But as you imply in your question, what kind of attention? Is it going to be the same kind of mistakes? Is it going to be the same kind of emphasis on militarism? Is it trying to exaggerate a foreign threat? Is it going to be an effort to manufacture crises that's going to create future confrontations down the line? And we're not talking about just individual terrorist groups or a few despots of middle powers. We're talking about a potential rival superpower in the form of China. But I think that the underlying issue is that we really need to recognize that there are limits to what military power can do, that the United States does not have the means of creating a world in our image, being able to make things go the way that we want to. We're going to have to think about limits of power. We're going to have to think about compromise. We're going to have to think about non-military solutions. And we need to recognize that we really can't afford to be the world's policeman anymore, that this pressing needs at home. I mean, the United States is falling behind in so many areas that prior to COVID, I traveled abroad a fair amount, and it was just amazing to go to all these countries in Asia and Europe and whatever and see broadband internet internet everywhere, to see high-speed rail, to see, you know, basic infrastructure, healthcare, other needs taken care of, things that we can't do. The United States is becoming a more backward country. Why? Because we keep getting and spending the majority of our discretionary federal budget on the military every year instead of needs at home. And I think what happened in Afghanistan is it will hopefully be a reminder of people that, yeah, you can have all the guns you want. You can be really, really powerful and spend all this on the military. But you can't even stop a ragtag band of religious fanatics in rural Afghanistan from taking down a government we spent trillions of dollars to prop up, you know, over the years. I mean, we need to really reevaluate our understanding of security and national interests.
Stephen Zunis, thanks a lot for talking to us. Where do we find your book on nonviolence and some of your other writing on international issues?
You can check my website, stephenzunis.org. That's stephenzunes.org. My most recent article, which is not yet up on my website, you can find in Truth Out, where I talk about the history of the U.S. role in Afghanistan. That's truthout.org. And on my website, you will find links to my books, both the nonviolence book and Tinderbox, but also I'll soon be releasing the second edition of my book on Western Sahara, the little-known conflict where the U.S. has facilitated Morocco's invasion occupation of the nation of Western Sahara, and how the U.S. is basically, once again, running roughshod over very fundamental principles of international law and the United Nations Charter and others in order to support the aggressive designs of a right-wing ally.
Stephen Zunis, keep up the good work. Thanks for talking to us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
That was the Mole's History Lesson for today. Bill Resnick speaking with Middle East specialist Stephen Zunis. You're listening to KBOO, your community radio station in Portland. Next up, Chelsea Ratzlaff talks with Chicana lesbian activist, musician, and writer Naomi Little Bear Morena about climate change, Naomi's own music, and how art can help heal the wounds of trauma and empower our movements.
Estas son las mañanitas que cantaba el rey David. A las muchachas bonitas se las cantaba así. Despierta, mi bien, despierta.
That was Song to a Dying Star by Portland-based musician and writer Naomi Little Bear Morena. Naomi is a lesbian Chicana musician and writer known internationally for her contribution to the seminal third-wave feminist anthology, This Bridge Called My Back, as well as her song Can't Kill the Spirit, which has been adopted around the world, most famously by the Greenham Common Peace Camps in the 1980s to protest the storing of nuclear cruise missiles, which lasted nearly two decades and was some 30,000 women strong. I'm speaking with Naomi today about the role of art and resistance in the age of climate collapse. Thank you for joining me today, Naomi, and welcome back to The Mole.
Thank you, Chelsea. Thank you so much for having me.
Song to a Dying Star is a revisiting of a song that you wrote in 1984. Can you talk about why you're choosing to revisit some of these songs?
Back in 1984, we were learning a lot about acid rain, and I was very concerned about the health of our planet, of our Earth Mother. Prior to Dying Star, I had written a song in my early 20s that was called Million-Eyed Woman, and that was really the first vision I had of the Earth needing our help in order to survive, and all the creatures, because the message I got in that vision, I was in Mexico at the time, was that if we didn't take care of our Earth, that the spirit would no longer be there to create and foster Earth. That song I wrote in a very gentle manner because I felt at that time that was the way to reach people, is to give them some poetry to listen to, something that would move them. With deciding to bring Dying Star back in a response to the severe climate warming that we are currently experiencing and the danger that our planet is currently experiencing, I believe that climate change is the most critical crisis that we are facing, and it faces everyone, regardless of political persuasion. And I think because I'm an Indigenous person, my connectivity to the earth is very deep. I want to support those younger generations who are fearing they won't have a world without climate change, that they won't have a world without some of the things that we have taken for granted, past generations, clean water, clean air. So the earth is burning up, and I'm very concerned for what we are leaving behind for our younger generations. And I want the song to be a wake-up call. In Dying Star, the last words are in Spanish, and it says to wake up. And that is a reflection of me going back to what drove my spirit to speak on behalf of the earth, an emissary maybe, and on behalf of women, because women are also being destroyed and raped and murdered all around the earth. The connection between violence against the earth and violence against women is the fact that we are destroying this body that produces life, that produces nourishment and nurturance, and the food that we have needed to survive as humans on this planet. My son is on the song. He's 16, and I want him to be able to have a future, and his children and their children. And I want to bring this song out as a wake-up call. It's not presenting itself in a gentle tone. It's presenting itself in this energy, this female energy that can be loud and angry and can thrash on a guitar. That's the energy that we have been suppressing from women. We don't want women to step out of their role of being nice and pleasant and polite all the time. We punish women for daring to speak out and to be angry about what is happening to our earth.
We're conducting this interview following the hottest July on record, with wildfire smoke turning the sun a now familiar and apocalyptic red. We're living through a mounting climate crisis. Can you talk about how your music has evolved in response to crises over the last several years?
I had taken a break from being a musician to be a mother, but I've never stopped paying attention to what's going on in the world. I think growing up in the barrio made me be extremely hypervigilant, in part because there was a lot of chaos, there was a lot of instability, there was drug addictions, there was family members dying from drugs and poverty and just trying to survive. And at the same time, I was also seeing the impact that the outside forces like police and the church, how they were in fact contributing to our state of poverty, their intent to kill our spirits, basically to kill our potential. One revelation that I have is that Black and brown people are not invisible. We are not invisible. We've always been here. We are just abused, ignored, and corralled into ghettos, reservations, barrios, so that you don't hear our knowledge, our wisdom, our intelligence. It's a threat, and it's more of a threat now. And this is how we contribute to the ecology. We contribute to the ecology of humanity by our hard-earned wisdom through the horrible experiences of institutionalized racism, environmental racism. We have so much information to give that can help heal the planet and get us back on track. It's important that we pay attention to those stories. A voice like mine is very rare. I'm Mexican American, and people see Mexicans as providers of food and labor that no one else wants to participate in. We are in the background, and they don't look to our mind and the music and the spirit that we have. This has been proven by the DACA recipients when we hear of their success stories. We say, yeah, see, This is what happens when you give people a chance, when you give brown people a chance to excel and to succeed, because in my generation, all exits out of poverty and racism and incarceration were closed. It took an extreme amount of effort on our part to be able to survive, and many of us did not survive. And in a sense, I feel very lucky I survived so much dysfunction and so much trauma. And that seems to inform my work.
How do you understand the role of art in mental health and community organizing?
When you are an oppressed people, and by that I mean that you have very few opportunities to attain or access education, food, proper nutrition, it makes you ill. When you are subjected to the inconsistent behavior of white people, when we go out into the world, we run into the friendlies and then we run into the not so friendlies. Trauma, by definition, is unexpected abuse. It's thinking that you're doing just fine, you're a black realtor and you're going to show this house, and you get arrested. All people of color have been deeply traumatized. They all suffer from PTSD in one form or another, anxiety, depression. As a child, I shut down because of so much trauma and so much neglect and abuse that music, I adored music. I listened to music as much as I could. Once I got older, I started teaching myself to play music. I decided that music was my identity, and it was my language. It was a long time before I realized that the songs that were coming into my head were actually coming from a deeper source of wisdom and a deeper source of information, and that the songs were also for my own benefit, that when I wrote something like You Can't Kill the Spirit, it became a widespread song that reverberated and gave people hope all over. And had I died or gone to jail, had I died of an overdose in the barrio, as would have been expected because that's what happened to some of my relatives, or if I had not been able to find my way, that song would have never been written. I have that little girl in mind, that brown little girl who was neglected so badly. You can make it. You have something, you have a voice, you have a song, you have some art. You have something that you can give that gives life not only to yourself but to others. But it doesn't mean that you may not suffer from mental illness. I suffered from mental illness, and music was the only thing that could pull me through. And that's because it was coming into me and saying, write this song about violence against women, write this song about violence against the earth, write this song about how we need to value one another. Every child of color has that capacity to give that if we clear the road of obstacles and if we become observant of what's going on around us and respond. If we're educators, we respond by teaching. If we're artists, we respond by creating. But we all have a role, and our role shouldn't be one of just complaining. It should be one of taking action and doing something. I'm 71 years old, and I'm still doing something. And I'm going to keep doing something because I think it's relevant. I don't think this message is dated to talk about the fact that this is our only home, that there's no planet B. That's not dated. That is more current than ever. And it's not for the currentness, it's for the fact that we absolutely can't fall asleep. So the last word on Song to a Dying Star is to wake up.
You mentioned that you're in a band with your 16-year-old son. I'm curious to know what message you want to give the young listeners and the older listeners. Like, what do you want them to know, especially about climate change?
Well, what I want them to know is to have hope. Don't give up. Don't ever give up. No matter what kind of ability you have, do it with whatever ability you have. The younger generations are very important to me because they are not to blame for the situation that we're in. greed and these absolutely insane climate deniers. And these people are out of their minds. They're completely out of reality. They have been brainwashed. This isn't a small fringe group of people that we can ignore. That's why we have to keep moving towards taking care of our mental health, moving away from the conspiracies, moving towards doing things that nurture our spirits and nurture our bodies and nurture the bodies of others. It's when you give that you receive. It's such a corny thing, but really, I know that so much of us are in want, but if you look at any poor community, they always take care of their own. But now we're a bigger community. We have to recognize that we're a bigger community and we need to take care of our own. We don't have to agree with everything, but we do have to agree that we need to save the planet by any means necessary, whether it's by righting the powers that be, electing better powers, doing everything we can our part to bring awareness to this, talk to people, teach people. Teach people skills. Teach the skills that you know. Because we all need to be multi-skilled. We need to learn a lot of things beyond just intellectualizing. We need to actually put things into action and make concrete progress in addressing climate change. I just want to encourage young people to know that some of us old folks are very concerned about this planet that we're leaving you. I promise that I want to do my part. At this point, all of us, because of the pandemic and because 4 years of being in an abusive relationship with an abusive president and now being abused by a party that has embraced white supremacy, that is frightening. It is absolutely frightening. But we can't just go up and beat them up. Believe me, I'd like to, but we can't. We have to be better than that by committing to being industrious in some way, by making tangible efforts to help people. Yesterday, we ran into some young people that were doing street response. That is the kind of work we need to keep doing. Because when we can do those things, we can distract ourselves from the trauma that all of us are now feeling, the trauma of watching politicians sanction murder and sanction abuse and torture of children, like the children at the border that were tortured. That's why I say we have to observe what's going on to seek that mental health. What I do is I take my son, we go out in nature all the time. We sit by the river because that's where we can clear our mind and let the bad feelings just be released and just take a plunge into a cold pool of water. Just have to keep waking ourselves up because there's such a potential to just give up, and we absolutely cannot afford to give up.
What does it mean to you to be a survivor?
It means that the Great Spirit wants me to live. I'm not a religious person, but I feel the power of the spirit of my ancestors. The knowledge of my ancestors is there if I let myself tune in. You know, we all get gifts from the spirit if we listen. Use those gifts, but don't use them to oppress or to put people down. Use them to help and to lift people up. So that's what I'm trying to do with my music, is I want to keep reminding you that the elders still care. We're not going to give up because we are survivors. We survived pre-gay liberation. We survived pre-civil rights. And now we're seeing it all descend into chaos. And so we have to untangle that mess and do it with purpose and good intentions.
Naomi, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom and your music and your work with us and for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you, Chelsea.
That was Chelsea Ratzlaff in conversation with singer-songwriter Naomi Little Bear Morena. Visit our webpage on kboo.fm for a link to Naomi's song, Survivors. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. Closing our show today, we have Jan Hawkins speaking with English professor Rachel Greenwald-Smith about her new book, On Compromise, Art, Politics, and the Fate of an American Ideal. Compromise, long held up as a necessary, even righteous, political tactic, has had consequences, especially for Black and Indigenous communities, not the least of which is to restrain the radical change we need to create a better society.
Welcome to KABU, Rachel Greenwald-Smith.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Well, in addition to your teaching at St. Louis University and a previous book on the literary establishment in the age of neoliberalism, you've written a number of essays on politics and popular culture. This new book on compromise, art, politics, and the fate of an American ideal is sort of hybrid work, part memoir, part cultural commentary, part philosophical critique. And we learn in this beautifully written and lively book some about your background as a guitar player in New York City and in our all-girl punk band, a bit of your history that alone is worth the read. So let's start today with the opening and ending scenes of the book. In the book's opening, you describe your reactions to a protest refrain at a women's march where you are participating, and the anthem, "This is what democracy looks like," an anthem that many of us are familiar with over the years of protest. And you point out that democracy is messy and it requires comfort with tensions and compromises. And you end the book with this same refrain that this is what democracy looks like. Can you say something about how you're using that anthem that we're so familiar with, who those of us who've been part of protest events?
Sure. The anthem comes in early in the book at the 2017 Women's March in Washington, D.C., that of course took place right after the aftermath of the 2016 election. And in that scene, I'm in the place where I have to be saying this is what democracy looks like in response to a chant leader, because I'm in this march but feeling ambivalent about it. For two reasons. One is that kind of hilariously, I'm chanting, "This is what democracy looks like," as the group of people I'm in is walking in the wrong direction without any sort of guidance as to where to go. So I reflect a little bit on how the sort of loose populist form of democracy can turn into just total chaos without any sort of direction. But on the other hand, I also find myself in that moment skeptical of that chant, because it initiates a process of thinking about some of the problems with how we might think about compromise politically today. So while in that moment, I'm kind of both disturbed and charmed by the sort of messiness of activist politics and sort of populist democracy, I'm also thinking about the invocation of compromise in more formal politics by centrist politicians who are asking for compromise as a solution to what they imagine to be a problem with overpolarization in the United States.
Well, let's talk about that in a moment, but I'd like to stay with the discussion of the Women's March. It's very, sure. It's a wonderful to read your commentary and how much I resonated with many of your observations. But you confess to a pleasure in being part of the march, but also have a kind of critique of the Women's March, but it's not fully developed. And could you say a little bit about that, the ambivalence you express, you know, as a feminist as well as a scholar? What are you trying to say there?
Sure. So on the one hand, my experience of actually being at the Women's March was one that was unlike maybe what I expected. I went there feeling ambivalently about the march, feeling that I had to be there in some sense because I was so angry about what was happening and so badly wanted to be involved in any sort of political response to it. I'd also been invited to go to Washington, D.C. to stay with friends who I very much wanted to see and miss terribly. So I had a personal reason for being there. At the same time, I had been concerned when the march was first raised by some of the hiccups that happened in the early planning, where it seemed that there wasn't enough intersectional representation in the planning group. That was happily rectified. But the march to me still had a sort of general association with a kind of more mainstream white feminist take that I think manifested later in the narrative of the march as being sort of a lot of people who celebrate, who supported Hillary Clinton in the 2016 election. And I voted for Hillary Clinton in 2016, but I did so despite the fact that I had vowed to never vote for her after her vote on the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq right after September 11th. Of course, those are coming back to haunt us now. And so I felt the march embodied a kind of contradiction that I see sort of throughout the book, actually, in a lot of the political examples, between, on the one hand, when I was actually there, feeling like it was a space of complexity, of dissent, of many different people from many different perspectives, of maybe some of the very best of coalition-based politics. But on the other hand, sometimes those things felt as if they were being erased toward a general narrative of kind of a more centrist agenda. And that made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah, in a sense, it's inevitable, and it's not simply girls can't get along or squabbles among women, but there's a long history of feminist politics spanning liberal feminism of the Hillary Clinton version and corporate aspirations of feminists versus cultural feminist, socialist, Marxist feminist, Black feminist thought has brought a lot into the recent Black Lives Matter movement, as well as other aspects of feminism. And so it's not surprising that the march was kind of dominated with the visual presence of liberal feminism. But I think that gets that obscures all of the complex and interesting, important history of feminism. So there's like polarization there as well, and in a sense, good, in a good sense. And you debunk this idea that polarization is a bad thing, that it's a pathology of our very contemporary post-Trump politics. And I think it'd be interesting to take up the way you use that line of critique in the chapter on the Missouri Compromise, which is a wonderful and very clever entree into your broad theme of uncompromise. Can you talk about that, the Missouri Compromise, as you relate it to racial politics and the history of liberalism?
Sure. So that chapter takes place. I should back up and say that most of the essays in this book do sort of move back and forth between the personal and the sort of critical political and aesthetic work that I'm doing. And that essay in particular is set in my hometown, which is St. Louis, Missouri. And it begins with the protests in Ferguson that followed the murder of Michael Brown in 2014. And thinks about the history of the Missouri Compromise and its legacy, both in Missouri and nationally. One of the first observations that for me gave rise to that chapter that I think is actually fairly startling, and I think we rarely think about this, is that for those of us who took sort of a basic U.S. history course at some point in our lives, whether that was in junior high or high school or college, we learn a series of compromises in U.S. history, beginning with the Three-Fifths Compromise and the U.S. Constitution, moving through the Missouri Compromise of 1820, and culminating maybe in the Compromise of 1877. In each of those compromises, essentially what happened was that the concerns of Black Americans, either as enslaved people, in the case of the Three-Fifths Compromise and the Missouri Compromise, or as people living in under Reconstruction in the South in the context of the 1877 compromise, that Black Americans' concerns were essentially traded away for white peace. And the fact that the word compromise, as it occurs in US history, has been, I think, used in many ways to erase that violence, and to see these progressive selling outs, essentially, of Black concerns as somehow being carrying the sort of positive valence of compromise. I think that that is a sort of, it's a manifestation of the way compromise in general can be used, the concept of compromise in general can be used to blanket over very important tensions and to justify the abdication of justice socially. So that's where that chapter starts. And then it kind of moves through both the history of St. Louis and political theoretical concerns about liberalism to think about what gets lost when we value compromise, especially around issues of race.
I think part of what's so instructive about that chapter is how what you call the virtue of compromise under liberalism, being a reasonable person, meeting someone in the middle, leaves out and represses so much of the history of marginalized and oppressed groups, that that's what's compromised rather than a general willingness to be rational.
That's absolutely right. And because that dispositional argument gets made about compromise, you know, this idea that people who compromise have better dispositions than those who are more extreme or those who are not willing to compromise, but that idea about the dispositional goodness of the compromiser causes all sorts of problems in our ability to see where justice is being served and when injustice is being tacitly consented to.
You also take up toward the end of the book some works and through literary works and some of your own history, the how we think about good people and bad people, these moral distinctions between extremists and those who are more rational, willing to compromise, and other ways of framing alliances and political enemies. Would you want to say something about that? Because that's a very big topic. And I think you open up questions, as in any good book, you open up questions that you can't possibly answer within the confines of the text. But in before we close, I would like to hear more of your thoughts on that, particularly as the charged political landscape of the country is characterized by so many pundits as a result of polarization and refusal to compromise. How you would cast the current or assess the current landscape through the lens of your book?
Thank you for that question. I think it's a really important one. So to begin, I guess, I think I make a distinction in the book between polarization and partisanship. And this isn't my distinction. This is a distinction that many people in political science and political theory have been working out for quite some time. But polarization more generally is, I think of as disagreements between groups of people about politics. Whereas partisanship has to do with an identification with a certain team or a certain type of person. And so one of the things I'm trying to do in the book is think about how polarization can actually be very healthy for a democracy. And in fact, how the tendency to value compromise on the left, beginning especially in the 1990s with the Clinton administration, and then running up through the present, has led to sort of depoliticization on the left until maybe 2016 or so, when the left became much more vocal and much more comfortable with a certain kind of extremity again, perhaps. But that period of time between the 1990s and 2016, the left really lost a lot of energy as a result of its antipathy toward polarization and its desire for compromise, I think, especially dispositionally. And that has partly given rise to the cultural climate that we see today, which I would characterize as a cultural climate of partisanship, in which people on the left and people on the right have gone further than just disagreeing with one another and toward hating one another. There's a whole set of theorists in political theory, people like Chantal Mouffe, for instance, who argue that it's precisely lack of opportunities for real political disagreement that lead people to replace politics with morality and start to think of one another as bad people. So in that climate, I mean, we're in a very difficult place now, obviously as a country, but I think within that, given that situation, it's really dangerous now to think that compromising can be a solution to the problems that we're encountering in terms of partisanship. And instead, I would say that we need as much robust debate as possible. We need a left that's really willing to stake strong claims and defend ground. And we may need to think of the right as a force to try to defeat rather than to try to compromise with.
Well, that's a fitting ending to our discussion today, which I'd love to return to down the road. This is Jan Hawken talking today with Rachel Greenwald Smith about her new book on compromise, art, politics, and the fate of an American ideal. There'll be a post on our website for those who want to get the book. It's a fascinating and fun read, as well as full of incredible insights. Congratulations on your book, Rachel, and thanks for being with us today.
That was Jan Hawken in a provocative discussion about political compromise with Rachel Greenwald Smith. And that's a wrap for our show today. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Chelsea Ratzliff, Jan Hawken, and their guests, Stephen Zunas, Naomi Littlebear Morena, and Rachel Greenwald Smith. Thanks as well to John Nelson for his editing assistance, and thanks to all the dedicated staff at our community radio station, KBOO, which is only on the air because of support from listeners like you. There's a big donate button on our website at kboo.fm. Please make it your friend. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Don't forget to visit our online retrospective, 30 Years in the Streets of Portland, the Activist Photography of Betty Lee. You can see her work and listen to an interview by going to kboo.fm and searching for Betty Lee. That's Betty spelled B-E-T-T-E. If you've been to a protest in Portland during the past 3 decades, you might even see yourself in one of her outstanding photos. Next Monday morning, we'll be back with more reflections, provocations, and inspirations of interest to those on the left. Until then, please keep yourself safe and stay active. I'm going to leave you today with a bit more of Naomi Little Bear Morena's wonderful music. This is a clip from her song, Can't Kill the Spirit.
But the song will live on.